America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. It is a day when President Biden did something he almost never does, which is he showed up on time. I know, really, this has been a problem. Of course, it's true in the Trump presidency, too. But President very late for his appointed time. But this press conference, long awaited, very significant, where the president just started speaking, pointedly on time. He began by talking about some of his accomplishments and the infrastructure bill and the tremendous increase in people who have been vaccinated. There were, he said, when he became a president, very few vaccinations. Only 2 million Americans had been fully vaccinated. Of course, vaccines had just come into distribution. And now over 200 million Americans are fully vaccinated. He continued to emphasize that is the way out of Omicron. And here is the president talking about some of the challenges ahead. If you have a strong response to the president of the United States, you can make your response through calling this show. 1-800-955-1776. We'll try to get you on as we can. Here's President Biden.
Administered at schools. And many states and school districts have spent this money very well. Unfortunately, some haven't. I encourage the states and school districts that use the funding to protect our children and keep our schools open. Use it. The COVID-19 is not going to give up and accept things, it's just not going to go away immediately. But I'm not going to give up and accept things as they are now. Some people may call what's happening now the new normal. I call it a job not yet finished. It will get better. We're moving toward a time when COVID-19 won't disrupt our daily lives, where COVID-19 won't be a crisis, but something to protect against and a threat. Look, we're not there yet, but we will get there. Now, the second challenge we're facing are prices. COVID-19 has created a lot of economic complications, including rapid price increases across the world economy. People see it at the gas pumps, the grocery stores, and elsewhere. So here's what we're going to do. A critical job in making sure that the elevated prices don't become entrenched rests with the Federal Reserve, which has a dual mandate, full employment and stable prices. The Federal Reserve provided extraordinary support during the crisis for the previous year and a half. Given the strength of our economy and the pace of recent price increases, it's appropriate, as the Federal Fed Chairman Powell has indicated, to recalibrate the support that is now necessary. I respect the Fed's independence, and I've nominated five superb individuals to serve on the Federal Board of Governors, men and women from a variety of ideological perspectives. They're eminently qualified, historically diverse, and have earned bipartisan praise. I call on the United States Senate to confirm them without any further delay. And here at the White House, and for my friends in Congress, the best thing to tackle high prices is a more productive economy with greater capacity to deliver goods and services to the American people, and a growing economy where folks have more choices and more small businesses compete, and where more goods can get to market faster and cheaper. I've laid out a three-part plan to do just that. First, fix the supply chain. COVID-19 has had a global impact on the economy. When a factory shuts down in one part of the world, shipments to shops and homes and businesses all over the world are disrupted. COVID-19 has compounded that many times over. A couple of months ago, in this very room, we heard dire warnings about how these supply chain problems could create a real crisis around the holidays. So we acted. We brought together business and labor, and that much-predicted crisis did not occur. 99% of the packages were delivered on time, and shelves were stocked. And notwithstanding the recent storms that have impacted many parts of our country, the share of goods in stock at stores is 89% now, which has barely changed from the 91% before the pandemic. I often see empty shelves being shown on television. 89% are full, which is only a few points below what it was before the pandemic. But our work's not done. My infrastructure law will supercharge your effort upgrading everything from roads and bridges to ports and airports, railways and transit, to make the economy move faster and reduce prices for families. Second thing, my Build Back Better plan will address the biggest cost of working families face every day. No other plan will do more to lower the cost of American families.
Now going back to Build Back Better is the President of the United States. The difficulty with all of this is, please note the tone, which is tremendously defensive. Now, again, if he's going to do a press conference like this, we'll see how it goes as he answers questions. The one thing that this is inevitably reminiscent of is what's known as the Jimmy Carter malaise speech, which really proclaimed Jimmy Carter just about giving up on winning re-election. And I don't mean that rationally. I think he had given up emotionally when he was basically attacking the American people for being irrationally upset for having a malaise. He never used the term malaise, but it became known as the malaise speech because he was talking about, why can't we come together? Why can't we recognize all the things that we have accomplished and that we've done and that we have looking forward to us? And partially, it came from the president's defensive tone. And with the president of the United States, with Joe Biden beginning this press conference, which I suspect a lot of people are listening to and a lot of people are interested in, beginning this press conference by saying, well, we've had a lot of accomplishments, but we've had a lot of challenges. And then trying to list his accomplishments, things like the infrastructure bill, things like the number of vaccinations, pleading for more vaccinations. I think that the difficulty right now is that with all of the extreme partisanship and the disillusionment, even of some folks, there's a report on how even those columnists who have been most supportive of Joe Biden and most behind his attempts at leading the government have said that he needs a real recalibration, a reset. Now, that's not going to come in this press conference, but it may need to come in the State of the Union address, which is actually it's coming up about a month from now. So who knows what the situation is going to be with the stock market, with the economy, and above all, with dealing with the Omicron pandemic. And one of the reasons I believe that it was scheduled for the 1st of March is that's when the predictions appear to be today, and I think many people consider them credible predictions, that by the 1st of March, we should definitely have turned some kind of corner in reducing the amount of infection and the rate of infection and certainly the rate of death and hospitalization with the pandemic. I think that part of what is going to be recorded by history as devastating to the Biden administration is not the pandemic of COVID. It's, you'll pardon me, it's the pandemic of promises and the big goals that most of which were clearly impossible from the very beginning because he wasn't elected for that and because he certainly did not have the kind of congressional support that would have been necessary. We'll be right back with more on the political ramifications and the conclusion of Biden's first year and more of his press conference coming up. President Biden acknowledging many of the disappointments that have been associated with his first year and blaming it all, as he just appeared to do, I think somewhat effectively, on Republicans and challenging Republicans to say, okay, what are you for? You have come to Washington with no intention other than to block everything that Biden wants to do. What are you for? And again, there is, unfortunately, I don't believe any one Republican who was set up to try to answer what Joe Biden is saying in his press conference. Because one of the things that the Republicans should answer in terms of that challenge is we are, first of all, in favor of the same kind of bipartisan government that President Biden campaigned on. We are for trying to bring the nation together, not demonizing your opponents as racists and neo-fascists and people with whom you can't even try to work. And President Biden is now taking questions. Let's listen.
I think it's extremely realistic to say to people, because let me back up. You all really know the politics in this country and your networks and others. You spend a lot of time, which I'm glad you do, polling this data, determining where what the American people's attitudes are, et cetera. American people overwhelmingly agree with me on prescription drugs. They overwhelmingly agree with me on the cost of education. They overwhelmingly agree with me on early education. They overwhelmingly go on the list on child care. And so we just have to make the case of what we're for and what the other team's not for. Look, we knew all along that a lot of this was going to be an uphill fight. And one of the ways to do this is to make sure we make the contrast as clear as we can. And one of the things that I think is we're going to have to do is just make the case. I don't think there's anything unrealistic about what we're asking. I'm not asking for castles in the sky. I'm asking for practical things the American people have been asking for a long time, a long time. And I think we can get it done.
You're not going to scale down any of these priorities, but so far that strategy isn't working. You haven't been able to get some of these big legislative ticket items done.
Well, I got two real big ones done, bigger than any president has ever gotten in the first year.
But currently, Mr. President, your spending package, voting rights legislation, they're not going anywhere. So
that's true.
Is there anything that you are confident you can get signed into law before the midterm elections?
Yes, I'm confident we can get pieces, big chunks of the Build Back Better law signed into law. And I'm confident that we can take the case to the American people that the people they should be voting for who are going to oversee whether the elections, in fact, are legit or not, should not be those who are being put up by the Republicans to determine that they're going to be able to change the outcome of the election. So whether or not we can actually get an election. And by the way, I haven't given up. We haven't finished the vote yet on what's going on the on voting rights and the John Lewis bill and others. But so, look, this is, I've been engaged a long time in public policy. And I don't know many things that have been done in one fell swoop. And so I think the most important thing to do is try to inform, not educate, inform the public of what's at stake in stark terms, and let them make judgments and let them know who's for them and who's against them, who's there and who's not there, and make that the case. And that's what I'm going to be spending my time doing in this off-year election.
You mentioned Republicans and reaching out to them. Some Republicans who may be open to major changes on voting rights, for instance, like Mitt Romney, he says he never even received a phone call from this White House. Why not?
I like Mitt. Look, Mitt Romney's a straight guy. He's one of the things that we're doing, I was trying to make sure we got everybody on the same page in my party on this score. And I didn't call many Republicans at all. The fact is that I do think that Mitt is a serious guy. I think we can get things done. I think I predict to you they'll get something done on the electoral reform side of this. But rather than judge what's going to get done and not get done, All I can say is I'm going to continue to make the case why it's so important to
Did you notice any answer about why, other than just ignoring it? He never called Mitt Romney. Did he ever call Susan Collins? Did he ever call Lisa Murkowski? Did he ever call any of the Republican leaders? And there are a lot of them, actually, including
people like
John Thune, who's in the leadership, who said that they are willing to talk about bipartisanship.
Fairly conducted and its results will be legitimate?
Well, it all depends on whether or not we're able to make the case to the American people that some of this is being set up to try to alter the outcome of the election. And it's one thing, look, maybe I'm just being too much of an optimist. Remember how we thought not that many people were going to show up to vote in the middle of a pandemic? We had the highest voter turnout in the history of the United States of America. Well, I think if, in fact, no matter how hard they make it for minorities to vote, I think you're going to see them willing to stand in line and defy the attempt to keep them from being able to vote. I think you're going to see the people we're trying to keep from being able to show up, showing up and making the sacrifice it needs to be made in order to change the law back to what it should be. But it's going to be difficult. I make no bones about that. It's going to be difficult. But we're not there yet. We've not run out of options yet, and we'll see how this moves.
And on Omicron and education, teachers are in revolt in so many places. Parents are at odds over closing schools and remote learning. You say we're not going to go back to closing schools. You said that just moments ago. Yet they're closing in some areas. What do you say to those teachers and principals and parents about school closings? And what can your administration do to help make up for learning loss for students?
First of all, I put in perspective the question you asked. Very few schools are closing. Over 95% are still open. So you all phrase the questions when people, I don't think it's deliberate on your part, but you phrase the question when anyone watches this on television. My God, there must be all those schools must be closed. What are we going to do? 95% are still open, number one. Number two, the idea that parents don't think it's important for their children to be in school, and teachers know it as well. That's why we made sure that we had the ability to provide the funding through the Recovery Act, through the act that we...
The president is talking about schools opening. One school that has been largely open, though not displaying much of an open mind, is the University of Washington, where a professor has gotten into a world of trouble because he declines to give the university-prescribed land use acknowledgement, trying to tell students before they begin any learning that, hey, you're on occupied stolen land from the native tribes that were once here. Why is he taking that stand? What does it mean? We'll talk to Professor Stuart Regis, a teaching professor of computer science and engineering at University of Washington, coming up. Michael Medved Show, it is a pleasure to welcome to this show an academic at the University of Washington. Stuart Regis is a teaching professor in the Paul G. Allen School of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of Washington. He teaches introductory programming classes. He participates in the design of undergraduate curricula. And he's involved in K-12 outreach, and he's held similar positions at Stanford and the University of Arizona in a career spanning 35 years. And by the way, it is worth noting that he has won extraordinary number of teaching awards at these institutions, including University of Washington and Stanford. Professor Regis, you're in trouble now, at least you're being claimed. You're fomenting a hostile environment because of what's called your version of land acknowledgement statements. Yep. First of all, can you explain to people, because there are a lot of folks out there who probably don't know, what is a land acknowledgement statement, and when did you first when were you first invited to make that statement?
Well, this is something that they've had in Canada and Australia for a while now, and it's just starting to come to the United States. The idea that when we have an event or, you know, a course that we kind of frame the event or the course by acknowledging the history of Native American tribes that occupied this land in the past. So it's an idea that kind of came out of the progressive, you know, ideology of what we should be doing for diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Right, and a typical land acknowledgement that is approved by the University of Washington says, we acknowledge that the U.S. Constitution was written and signed on the homelands of the Lenape people, the indigenous people who were forced from their homelands under the threat of violence in the 18th century as a result of the European colonization of that land. Now, aside from putting this in the syllabus that describes the course you're teaching, are you expected at UW to give that kind of land acknowledgement statement verbally at the beginning of each class?
I know of some instructors here at UW who do that, who do it at the beginning of every class. That's not been recommended yet, but we had a faculty retreat at the beginning of the year, and it was opened with a land acknowledgement. You know, I think they think that all the major events should basically begin with a land acknowledgement.
Okay, so you put an acknowledgement in the syllabus, and I know it's going to be very horrifying to people to actually hear it, but at the risk of creating a toxic environment on the radio, I will read the very brief land acknowledgement that you agreed to place in the syllabus. It says, I acknowledge that by the labor theory of property, the Coast Salish people can claim historical ownership of almost none of the land currently occupied by the University of Washington.
Yes.
What was your thought here?
Well, nobody likes these things that I know, and I dislike the whole idea of framing a course kind of. I think this sends the message that progressive ideology is what's going to be in this course. So I wanted to send something that was not progressive ideology, something that was more standard Western culture. So this comes out of John Locke's Second Treatise of Government, where he said that the way that you come to own land is, say, by growing crops on the land, by mixing your labor with the land. And the UW, you know, the 350 acres for the main campus, they were just forest, you know. They had to clear all the trees and level the ground. It was not something where Native Americans were farming, for example, the kind of thing that John Locke would have said gave them ownership of the land.
Okay, so basically you're not denying that the Coast Salish people, members of various tribes in the area, lived near the land of the UW. But did they, by the way, did they actually, any evidence that they actually had villages or any sort of permanent or semi-permanent homes on land that is now occupied by the UW?
That I don't know. It may be that the original campus, which is closer to downtown, I think, may have been something where Native Americans had some kind of a village or something. I don't know that much about that history, but it's partly also just the idea that it's not a principle of government to say, well, you were in this space and therefore you somehow own all of this land. You know, I mean, how many acres does that give you ownership to? 1,000, 1,000,000, you know, a state?
Well, it also, your point also goes to a point that I've made on the air about all of this, which is that the Native tribes, if you look at it, they didn't have a conception of land ownership.
That's exactly they were right. Yeah, yeah.
Semi-nomadic peoples.
Yeah, oh, sorry, yeah. If anything, they would have said the land was owned in common. You know, that they didn't have this concept of an individual owning these particular, you know, plot of land.
Yeah, and again, your point that there were forests there generally, you can even look at photographs of them preparing for the AYP, the Alaska Yukon Pacific Exposition, a World's Fair, where they cleared away a lot of forests where the UW sits right now in order to make a World's Fair where they had some fairly racist displays, but that's another story.
Right.
So what happens with this? Are they claiming, the administration, that you're creating a toxic environment?
That was the phrase they used. There were students who complained. I think most of my students either didn't notice or didn't care, but a few students noticed and complained, and then they kind of freaked out. They were just like, this has to go. You know, they deleted it from my syllabus. They apologized to my class. They set up an alternate section of the course at the same time so that students who were so deeply offended by me could take the course from someone else. I mean, all because this was so amazingly insulting, supposedly, to the class.
Are you tenured?
No, I'm a teaching faculty member.
Yeah, is there some threat to your future, University of Washington?
Always, yeah. 2 years ago, when I was up for renewal, they did something they haven't done with any other teaching faculty member, which is they gave me just a one-year extension. They normally give a three-year extension, but they kind of put me on probation for a year because of other controversies I've been involved with.
Can you hold on for a moment? Because I would
sure.
like to find out, and I bet there are a lot of people listening to us who would like to find out if there's anything they can do to support you on this. Because whether you agree or disagree with Professor Regis about this question of land acknowledgement, and I happen to agree with him, it's a very important statement, it's very important what he's doing. There are a lot of people, I think, who believe that the freedom of speech is absolutely essential to a university system. I know that there's a foundation for FIRE, which
right.
stands for Foundation for, what is it?
Individual Rights in Education.
There you go, which is a very worthwhile goal. I know that is providing you with some support for people here in the University of Washington area. And by the way, has anyone else that you know of, and we'll get to this in just a moment when we get back with Professor Regis, about whether there are other faculty members who are showing the courage, the gumption, the integrity, to use an old-fashioned word, the integrity to actually resist some of the politically correct and, frankly, America-hating nonsense that is part of a contemporary ideology that is often imposed at universities. We will be right back with Professor Stuart Regis coming up on the Michael Medved Show.
Michael Medved.
I'm listening to everything you say.
Washington
acknowledges the Coast Salish peoples of
this land,
the land which
touches the shared waters
of all tribes and bands
within the Suquamish,
Tulalip,
and Muckleshoot nations.
Okay, that was actually not a satire. That was part of a UW website. Provided by the University of Washington, of what they see as a model land acknowledgement, I guess having different voices recited in class. And part of what they are saying is the University of Washington acknowledges the Coast Salish peoples of this land, the land which touches the shared waters of all tribes and bands within the Duwamish, the Puyallup, the Suquamish, the Tulalip, and the Muckleshoot nations. And then they add this that I wanted to ask Professor Stuart Regis about, acknowledging the ceded and unceded land, and that's ceded, not S-E-D-D-E-D, it's ceded as in you ceded, gave it up, acknowledging the S-C-E-D-E-D and unceded land on which we all stand, could not be more important in our current historical moment.
You know, okay, one of the things about that is if you read the university webpage where they talk about that particular land acknowledgement, they say that what you're acknowledging there is that the university sits on occupied land. If it really is occupied land, let's give it back. I mean, no one seriously believes that we should give this land back to the tribes.
Well, of course, the Puyallup Nation, I'm sure, could do a better job managing the University of Washington, 350 acres. You must have talked to some people about this when they say it could not be more important in our current historical moment. I mean, we have a lot of problems right now. I mean, we have problems with the pandemic, with rising inflation, with the fact that World War III is about to break out between Russia and Ukraine. Well, there's serious problems. What is it that we are supposed to do in our current historical moment to address this problem of occupied land?
Well, you know, this is part of this broader agenda of cultural change, you know, that it generally is called diversity, equity, and inclusion. And the desire is that we make this our number one focus. I mean, we have a five-year plan where we talk about all the things we're going to do in the Allen School and in the College of Engineering and at the university level to try to address diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I just think this is very dangerous. It's not what we should be focusing our attention on. And this seemed to me to be one of the weak points. There's a First Amendment issue that they, I think, have not thought through very carefully, that if they encourage you to make a land acknowledgement, they can't require you to make it a progressive land acknowledgement. They can't say the conservative version is banned, but the progressive one is okay.
That's a very, very interesting and important point. Where does this stand right now? Are you in the upcoming syllabus being allowed to include your land acknowledgement?
Well, they took mine away, you know, and set up this alternate class. I was pretty sure there was a First Amendment issue here because the University of Washington is a state school, so it has to obey the First Amendment. So, you know, any restrictions on speech have to be content neutral. I thought that was true, and I was very pleased that this group, FIRE, they have a legal defense fund, that they agreed, and they wrote to the university, put out a press release. So they're pressuring the university to reverse this policy, and we'll see what the university does. I think the university is going to ignore them, you know, but I think it's great to have FIRE on my side, and I don't know what a next step might be. I mean, we're waiting to see what they say, but you know, I plan to use this again in the spring, you know, when I teach, and I don't know what the university will do if I do that. You know, they freaked out when I did it this quarter.
Well, Ben, by the way, let me mention, back in 2012, which is not that long ago, you won the Distinguished Teaching Award, which is the highest award given by the University of Washington for teaching.
Yep.
Now is that invalidated because of your heinous refusal to give the kind of, quote, land acknowledgement that they want?
Well, they haven't taken it back yet, but the Student Senate has spent a lot of time denouncing me. They apparently last week spent their whole agenda time, I mean, their whole meeting time, talking about a resolution to try to counter my syllabus. You know, the statement I had on my syllabus.
Now, do you teach classes on programming, right? And you teach classes on computer science.
Yep.
Is there any way that you're supposed to bring in the treatment of Native Americans 200 years ago? Or is there some way you're supposed to incorporate that into teaching about computer science?
Well, as part of this diversity, equity, and inclusion push, they've said that we should try to be incorporating issues of justice in our courses. But then, you know, one of the things our director said is that my version of the land acknowledgement has nothing to do with computer science, so it doesn't belong on the syllabus. But the other version, you know, she thinks should be on the syllabus.
Wait, so, again, you acknowledge, I'm sure, in your classes all of the tremendous contributions of the Native American nations to the development of computer science.
Sure. Well, and it's a very, we have a very complicated relationship, you know, a complicated history with lots of, you know, I mean, it's, I'm not trying to whitewash and say, you know, we've had wonderful relations with Native Americans all of this time. It's, you know, but this was really a way for me to see whether it was possible to say something different. And I didn't think it was insulting to kind of say that there's a different way of looking at land and who owns it.
Right. I mean, and again, I think just it's you're doing a public service by asking people to acknowledge John Locke's labor theory of property and the whole idea that property involves some involvement of work on that property and of human ownership. Speaking of human ownership, do some of your colleagues at the university suggest that we should be paying rent, the taxpayers of the state of Washington, that we should be paying additional rent to the Native nations who at once inhabited part of the land on which the university now sits?
Well, the most absurd thing is that everybody knows that these things are useless, that we're not really committing to anything. You know, it's just... I don't know what it means to acknowledge. I've said that these things have almost the status of a prayer, you know, and a lot of times people say a prayer without really meaning to change their lives very much.
Yeah. What about your colleagues? Have you had some expressions of sympathy or support behind closed doors from some other members of the faculty?
There are a small number of faculty who are, you know, very supportive of what I'm doing. Most people tend to say, well, I think these land acknowledgments are stupid, but I think you're being rude. That's kind of the most common thing I've heard. And then there's a small number of people who want me fired over it.
Well, what I would like to do is, Jeremy, let's put up the information on FIRE, which is actually trying to represent, I think, Professor Regis's interest in standing up to all of this. That the difficulty to me is it seems that the core goal of this land acknowledgement movement, which is sweeping the country, is very similar to the core goal of so-called critical race theory, which is to make young people coming into American society feel guilty and regretful about the way that people built these institutions that are right now benefiting them.
Yes, and to say this is a course in which progressive values are going to be dominant. This is a course where, you know, we agree, as you say, with kind of the whole critical view of the United States and American society. It's a patriarchy. We're systemically racist, et cetera. We stole the land from the Native Americans. It's all part of a kind of a progressive campaign that I've called the equity agenda. They're trying to change the culture. They're trying to change the way people view the United States.
No, exactly right. I have been speaking considerably about the struggle between a guilt and gratitude. And gratitude is actually a characteristic that can improve character and improve institutions. Guilt, not so much. Where this goes next, it seems to me, have you been able to continue teaching classes without finding your class time taken up with these discussions, just quickly?
Yeah, I've been able to continue teaching.
Well, congratulations for the courage and the pertinacity and the determination that you display. That is Professor Stuart Regis of the University of Washington. Long may he serve, and find out about his case and the way you can support it, because it deserves support, at michaelmedved.com in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.